Blog Talk Radio.
Radio Free Palmer, 89.5 KVRF, presents Mushing Radio, hosted by Robert Forto. Mushing Radio is about dog-powered sports, living in the Great White North, and mushing. Visit our website at mushingradio.com. Here is your host, Robert Forto.
Welcome, everybody. This is Robert Forto. You're listening to Mushing Radio here on KVRF 89.5 in the Mattsu Valley, radiofreepalmer.org. And all of our online archive episodes can be heard on mushingradio.com. Make sure you follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Just search for Mushing Radio in the search box, and you will pull us right up. Today is a special guest here on Mushing Radio, one of the original Iditarod mushers. His name is Rod Perry, calling in from Wasilla. Rod, how's it going this evening?
It's going great.
Very good. So how is the weather in Wasilla? Over here in Palmer, boy, I tell you what, we got the fans blaring in the studio, and it is the middle of spring here in Alaska already, isn't it?
It's beautiful. It's one of my favorite times of the year. It's the time I used to really like to get out and travel with the dog team and camp and go up to Montana Creek and train lead dogs with Ron Aldrich. When the snow has covered all the brush and logs, you can go anywhere and just gee-haw your dogs through the woods like you're going through a park.
Wow. You know, it is a special time for mushing. You know, a lot of people are packing it in for the season, prepping all those projects around the house, but we still have some stuff to talk about here on Mushing Radio, and I'm glad that we were able to touch bases here. An original Iditarod musher you are. I think that's a story in of itself. But before we get too involved with this, can you give us a little bit of history about you? I know we could probably talk for half an hour just talking about who you are, but maybe a brief bio about who you are and what you're all about.
Sure. I grew up in a little town of about 175 in the wintertime on the Oregon coast with the surf pounding right out in front of the house and behind the house, 1,000-year-old forest. My parents both came from real rural backgrounds. My mother grew up on a land claim in New Mexico when Pancho Villa was raiding in the country. And my dad, they had a homestead and trap line living among the First Nations people of Alberta. And my dad never had a pair of shoes on until he was 12, all Sarsi moccasins. All our trapping and hunting partners were Native. So I grew up with this heritage and with that great forest right behind the house and dad to teach me, I just grew up very, very woodsy. But I was an Alaskan from the time I was about 8. I just wasn't old enough to run away yet. And as soon as I could shake free at age 20, I set my course north. And so this is my 51st year in Alaska.
Wow.
I first heard about the Iditarod while attending a Willow Winter Carnival in, I believe it was 1970. Walked over to say hi to a friend of mine, Tom Johnson, who ended up being one of the co-founders of the Iditarod, along with Leo Hike. They helped Joe Reddington.
Right.
And with him was standing a fellow that turned out to be Dan Seavey, and then a fellow that I recognized but had never met formally, and that was Joe Reddington himself. And the topic of their conversation soon had me virtually levitating. They were talking about this wild, revolutionary new concept in sled dog racing they wanted to test drive. They planned to run from Connect to Iditarod and return 800 miles just to test a man and dog against the elements. Sounded to me like devil take the hindmost, every man for yourself, hell bent for leather. And, I was a little skewed in my idea of exactly how it would be. I thought it was every man pick his own route, and but anyway, I was hooked, and that led me to run the first Iditarod in 1973.
So you said that was in 1970 where you met those folks out there on the lake, right?
Yeah, it was 1970.
Winter Carnival.
Yeah, the Winter Carnival in 1970.
So it took 3 years to get the show on the road. Was there a lot of naysayers back then, or was everybody for it, you know, ready to go? Wow, this sounds like a great idea. Or was it kind of hush-hush in the dark until you guys were closer to the starting line, so to speak?
Well, up here in dog country around Palmer Wasilla, there was a pretty fair little contingent, little cadre of sort of wilder, really physical type adventurer, you know, kind of non-joiner types, a lot of them were trappers and people that weren't in any established dog club, didn't race their dogs. They were into it, but in Anchorage, where I live, this will give you a hint. I was the only one who was prepared, who, you know, gave a hoot about it and who thought it might happen until at the very last minute, Daryl Reynolds heard about it and came in, but he got sick the first day. So anyway, I essentially ended up being the only one from Anchorage. Every week, a bunch of us in the Sled Dog and Racing Association, I didn't race sprints, but I was, they were the only doggy people around, and I was, it was fun to fraternize with them. So we'd go over to Dick Tozier's place. He ended up being the race marshal on the first Iditarods, and we'd fraternize there, and we'd watch Columbo and talk, and they all thought I was nuts. Dick didn't think it could possibly happen. Orville Lake, real kingpin in sled dog racing, he just really poo-pooed it. Dick didn't poo-poo it, but nobody thought it would actually come off, and so it was a bit of a surprise to them, I think, when Joe really started bringing things together. Joe plus Gleo and Tom plus a brand new Iditarod trail committee that they assembled with a bunch of young Anchorage movers and shakers.
Was it the distance, or was it the logistics, or the people involved? Why were they so thinking that it wasn't going to happen?
Well, there were a number of reasons, and you've hit on a couple. One was, Dick says, "Listen, Rod, look how much trouble we have putting in the Rendezvous Trail. We've got, you know, the whole city behind us. We've got our club, biggest sled dog and racing club in Alaska, if not the country, with, you know, myriad volunteers. All we have to do is just jump in their car and drive out, and at the most maybe jump on a snowmobile to go out to work on the trail. But a huge percentage of the trails, city streets, bike trails, and then we get down to club trails that we run all the time, all winter, and keep up. At the most, we have to put in a little extension out at the end, a loop. It comes right back and repeats itself coming back. And look how much trouble we have. How in the world is he going to put in 1,000 miles of trail, particularly with no money?
Right.
And so that brings up the second thing, no money. And nobody believed in it. So all you got were closed doors and stiff arms. And at best, people that just wanted to listen to some idiot talk about something that was, you know, looked like a delusion of grandeur. So no money, no trail, and then the logistics were just incredible to think about, especially, again, with no money. The complexity, you think of it today, and you think of the literal thousands of people that tackle all the myriad of tasks out there. And as it ended up, we might have had a couple dozen people at most doing what thousands do today. Just, you know, the detail, Edison,
mind-boggling.
Mind-boggling. And then think about this one to go up against when you're looking for sponsors. Chuck Raymond, who was certainly an acknowledged expert, Alaska's foremost commercial sled builder, told me as I went down to Kasiloff to pick up a hickory plank for Ron Aldrich and I to build a couple of sleds with, he says, "Rod, no dogs are capable of doing that. It'll kill them."
Wow.
I mean, so what sponsor wants to get behind something that would kill 1,000 dogs when, you know, a big oil company or somebody, something I mean, there's always a children's hospital or a fund for the blind or anything like that that is safe and would be just a very worthy place to put your money. So it was, it just seemed insurmountable.
So evidently, as we all know, history played out and the race did go on, and you were one of the mushers and the teams that were involved with that. How many mushers were involved in the first race there? What number of teams was entered?
34 started, 22 finished.
Wow.
And I believe, if I'm not mistaken, there's about 13 of us left alive who finished.
Wow. Those 34, typical scratches as we see today, or they just got out there and thought, wow, my goodness, I just wasn't prepared for anything like this?
Most of the people were really, really competent outdoorsmen. The field was much, much different than it is today.
Right.
Today, you find people from all walks of life. You'll find a hairdresser from Cincinnati and an accountant from London, and I mean, all back then, if you look down the list, pretty much it was, you know, trapper, big game guide, McKinley Mountain guide, commercial fisherman, a cabin builder, you know.
Right.
And then what we had also was, you think about this one, the very final, last trailing edge of the great Indian and Eskimo dogmen. And I'm not including in that the Athabascans and the Eskimos that drive dogs today. I'm talking about out of necessity dogmen, people who were every morning would get up and harness the team to go out and do what they needed to do, just like we start up the car and go to work.
Right.
And there were no snow machines. It was going to get done. Every head of family had to have a dog team back then in that mixed subsistence and trapping and trading economy that the bush was in.
Very interesting stuff. Rod, I definitely want to ask about the dogs. Obviously, you've traveled much slower than by today's standards. You know, now they're doing it in 9 days plus, but hasn't been over 11 days in a while. What is the amount of time that it took you and your team to cross the finish? I know it was a much different race back then in terms of where it started and where it ended, but what was your time coming into the finish?
It took me 30 days.
Wow.
30 days. And what was happening with me is I'd been a very successful athlete. I'd been twice state champion wrestler. And I was used to being able to compete on a fairly high level, so it was a little bit frustrating for me to know that I couldn't compete. On the other hand, I just felt so fortunate to be in on that. You know, I've often said that there's been, 42 Iditarods now? 41 fit in the box. There's nothing that you could throw at a Didi or a Rick that they wouldn't say, yeah, we've seen something like that before, or we've seen something exactly like that before.
Right.
Or if it's a variation, like maybe Jeff King comes up with an innovation, it's not really surprising to them. And they all fit in that Iditarod experience box, but there's one race that does not fit at all. Nothing like it has ever happened again, and that's that first Iditarod. It was the Lewis and Clark expedition of Iditarod. So one time only, plunge into the unknown, the vast experiment. And then I was fortunate to have been on the second one also and see the difference. And from the second one on through however many you want to, I mean, you could draw the line at 20 or 25 or 30 because they're just gradually phasing. But from there on, it was covered wagon train trips over the Oregon Trail where back in the days, the middle 1800s, each covered wagon, each season, the guides would know more about how to, you know, guide the trains across, and they'd know more about what to take and what to leave and how to do it and whether oxen or mules were best. At a certain point, our Iditarod became more like a Ferrari run from Independence to Portland over the interstate with all the safety nets and infrastructure and, you know, just the handy gas stations and motels and hotels and cities. And now it's not an adventure in the same sense that it once was. If you look at the definition of the, in the dictionary of adventure, I'm not saying it's a Nancy visits the farm level experience at all. It's just one whale of a pure race. Just a whale of a pure race. Go ahead.
Do you think that is good or bad in your opinion? Do you think that it's changed so much that it has watered down, I guess, the history or kind of the romance of the Iditarod?
Well, it's just different. I'm not going to say it's better or worse. I was tremendously attracted to that plunge into the unknown nature of the first one, and then those of us that were competitive that ran the first one, you know, found it hard. When we learned so much, the learning curve was so steep at first. We learned so much it was almost impossible not to go back again and put into play all those shoulda, coulda, woulda, you know, I know what I'd do next type concepts. So the first races were really exciting in that way too. So I'm not going to say one's better than the other. It's just different. And now it's just one tremendous athletic contest.
Well, you're doing it about a third of the time than you had finished. You said 30 days or so, and now they're just shy of 9.5, 10 days. So if we could, Rod, I know this is a very short show, only a half hour. We're talking to Rod Perry tonight on Mushing Radio. You can check out his website at rodperry.com. He has a couple of very cool books. Trailbreakers, I believe, is the name of it. Is that right?
Yes, Trailbreakers, Pioneering Alaska's Iditarod. Volume 1 is about how the trail was born. I was appointed by the Secretary of the Interior to the National Historic Trails Advisory Council way back in the late 70s, so I've got a long background in trail history. And then, and some people have said, Rod, what you've got there really is more of maybe one of the best, if not the best, rendition of how what I call the Great Northwest Subcontinent, Yukon Territory in Alaska, how that was brought from the Stone Age into the Industrial Age. Anyway, that's the first book. The second one, by the same name, Trailbreakers, Pioneering Alaska's Iditarod, is how the race was born. All the struggles that Joe went through and some of these reasons I talked about why, you know, people poo-poo those who poo-pooed it back then, but they had very good reasons, like I mentioned, all those very good reasons why it didn't look like it could happen. But anyway, goes through that and then takes you through the founding first race.
So fast forward about 11, 12 years, now you're involved with another 1,000-mile race, the Yukon Quest, and there's a who's who of mushers involved with that, and namely Bud Smith, a very renowned mushing name, at least here in Alaska. What in the world got that rolling, and why in the world did you guys think you needed another 1,000-miler here in Alaska?
Well, that I always point to a broken place on a big freight sled that I've had down on 4th Avenue where I sell my books as the birthplace of Yukon Quest. It could be said that it is, in a sense, coming in from Lake Minchumina it was a trip of 16 full days and parts of two others. You know, it was one of these old-fashioned make-it-all-the-way-through-or-die trips, literally. To run the 1977 Iditarod, what I did was I made a beeline from Lake Minchumina by compass to a trapline trail I had spotted from the air. And on day 10, when we hit that trapline trail, I met Leroy Shank. He'd been in Alaska a little longer than I, but he'd never been on a dog sled. Well, he repaired that broken cross bent in my sled, We had to start, by the way, with almost 1,000 pounds of dog food to make it out of there with 22 dogs. And so while we were staying overnight at his cabin, he just got tremendously excited about the idea of maybe running his trap line by a dog team. So he proceeded to convert over from snowmobile to dog team for a couple of years. That led him to try the Iditarod. And he was a creative guy, and anyway, eventually it led him to come up with the idea to run from Fairbanks to Whitehorse and create a race to do so. So I went up to his place, camped in his yard that winter, and he and I and his friend Roger Williams, that worked at the News Miner with him, also had been in on that conversation when they came up with the idea for the run to Whitehorse. So Leroy, Roger, myself, we added Bud Smith and headed for Whitehorse to break the news to the Canadians. On the way over and back, we discussed different ideas for rules. We wanted to make sure the race was much different than the Iditarod. And we could already see that the Iditarod was losing one great aspect in our eyes, and that was the camping. It was becoming a checkpoint-to-checkpoint race, and we wanted to make sure the old woods and trail skills, survival skills, remained in this other race, and it appealed because what was easy to see was that although every one of the major checkpoints had air service into it, regular air service, and you could even drive to some of them, there was vast different distances between those checkpoints. One was over 300 miles. We wanted to keep that in there. I think they've put a checkpoint in between now. But we wanted to keep it in because we wanted to keep the camping in it and have this a wilderness race. So we wanted to make sure that it was more affordable than the Iditarod. And and we also, and it was my rule, I argued and argued, and they finally threw up their hands and said, okay, Rod, okay, we'll put a 12-dog limit on it and a 3-dog drop limit. And I remember when Ron Aldrich came home from that first race, he said, Rod, don't you guys change one single thing. It was great. They had 27 total drop dogs on the Yukon Quest. Now, that certainly makes the race more, affordable for the mushers and the administrators. So, anyway, we decided that the race would go one way one year and one way the next. That was another major concept. These things that we decided upon on that trip over and back, the four of us, became really rules that characterize the race to this day. The fact that you start one place one year and the opposite end the second or the next year. Stop over in Dawson, an established layover point instead of being able to choose. Bud's idea was that of the 36-hour layover instead of a 24. He felt like that would help get the lactic acid out of the dogs. I don't know if that is scientific or not, but that's what Bud figured. So the 12-dog and the 3-dog drop limit that's now increased to 14 and 4 was mine.
Wow.
A lot of that stuff started to influence the Iditarod. The Iditarod would look at the Quest, and the Quest would look at the Iditarod, and the Iditarod didn't used to have any limit at all as far as the number of dogs you could take. Bud created the record on that one. He took off with the greatest team in the history of the Iditarod. He didn't get very far before he got into a cuss fight with his old buddy Bobby Lee, and Bobby kicked him out of the race the first day. But Bud started out with 35 dogs and a giant sled with a dog hotel on it.
Looked like some of the sleds that were heading down the trail this year when they were leaving from Willow. A lot of definitely innovative stuff. And Rod, we just have a couple of minutes left. I wanted to get into that if we could. You had sent over several pictures and some information about
the sled that you had built and with the Ouija board and kind of harken back into the old days. Can you give us a quick story about that? And, of course, we're going to put some links to those stories and those pictures and videos on our show page when we're done. What inspired all of that, and what a way to ride down the trail with the two mushers and, you know, the Ouija board and the G-pole and the whole nine yards. What a way to mush.
Yeah, that all began in 2011 when Greg Bill, Iditarod's development director, asked me if I would run a historic reenactment celebrating 100 years of the Iditarod Trail. On my way, I kept thinking this thing could be done a lot better if we had a little bit more time, and so I started thinking of what I've called something I'd eventually like to produce, and that is a show before the show. I would like, if I had my way, to portray about a half dozen types of old trail users and uses of the trail. You know, a trapper, a freighter, a mail carrier, Bob Grippus running the Wells Fargo Gold Train, which is what we reenacted this year. See, these modern races are wonderful, the Quest and the Iditarod, in calling attention to the old trails, but what they don't do is give any glimpse of an idea to most people who have no idea about what the old trail use looked like. And, you know, what the equipment was like, what the dogs were like, what just the whole thing. So anyway, that's my goal, and this is a start. Wells Fargo was wonderful in backing us on this, as was John Norman with the Iditarod Foundation that Joe Reddington created. So we built this this sled. If you extend the G-pole out and call it part of the sled, it is a permanent part of the sled on a swivel. The sled's about 20 feet long.
Wow.
It weighs 240 pounds. It's got about four times the loading capacity on the bed of the sled as a modern race sled. It's about probably about eight times as heavy, and has a cargo capacity probably 10 times that. So anyway, this is the goal. This is something we're working on, and we're hopeful that it'll move forward from here and become a regular feature. I think it has tremendous potential. I'd like to fill up a whole hour, actually, in the hour before the Iditarod with this kind of a show. It'd be very educational and informative and entertaining.
Very good. Rod, we're just about out of time. Again, I want to make sure that we pass along your website, rodperry.com. Hopefully, Rod, we can have you back on again soon. We can pick up where we left off and continue to talk. I'm sure you and I could talk for hours about the history of mushing and where we were and where we're going today. So, Rod, it was my pleasure. Thanks for joining us tonight. We'll keep in touch, okay?
Okay. Love being on the show.
Thank you. Rod Perry this evening, one of the first Iditarod mushers here on Mushing Radio. We'll talk to you guys next time. Goodbye.